The Caribbean is often spoken about like a footnote. Small islands, warm water, vacation talk. That framing is convenient, and it is wrong. Since the 1900s, the Caribbean has shaped how the modern world works, sounds, eats, votes, and resists. Global cities move to Caribbean rhythms. Political language carries Caribbean fingerprints. Labor systems, migration policy, and racial order were tested here first, then exported outward. This region has never been quiet. It has been managed into silence. We live in a world where Caribbean culture travels freely, while Caribbean people are policed, where identity is consumed, but authority is denied, where influence is undeniable, yet relevance is questioned. So the pressure is not about proving importance. That question was settled long ago. The real tension is control. Who gets to define Caribbean value? Who profits from Caribbean presence? And why a region so small keeps showing up at the center of global power struggles? This is not a story about nostalgia. This is about relevance. Right now. Chapter 1. From Plantation to Pressure Point. The Caribbean entered the 20th century already wounded, but not defeated. The plantation system had done its work. Land was stripped. Labor was broken into categories. Race was hardened into policy. When slavery ended, the structure stayed. Power did not leave. It changed hands and language. By 1900, most Caribbean societies were still governed by external authority. Britain, France, the Netherlands, Spain, and the United States shaped borders, trade, and law. Local leadership existed, but it was constrained. Decisions about land, labor, and movement were made elsewhere. The region was still designed to serve someone else's economy. Plantations declined, but extraction did not stop. Sugar, bananas, bauxite, oil, and tourism replaced one another in cycles. Each promised development. Each kept profits moving outward. Caribbean people remained close to the work and far from the reward. This is where relevance begins, not in size or wealth, but in function. The Caribbean became a laboratory. Colonial powers tested labor contracts, wage controls, and racial hierarchy here. When those systems worked, they were exported. When they failed, the cost stayed local. This region absorbed experiments that shaped global capitalism. By the early 20th century, Caribbean workers were already moving. Some were recruited, others fled. Panama needed labor for the canal. Britain needed workers after two world wars. The United States needed cheap labor without political obligation. Caribbean people filled those gaps. Migration was not an accident, it was policy pressure. Men and women left Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, Haiti, Puerto Rico, and the smaller islands carrying more than muscle. They carried language, faith, discipline, and political memory. They built railways, ports, hospitals, and cities. At the same time, their absence weakened local economies at home. The region lost workers, thinkers, and organizers just as it needed them most. This tension mattered. The Caribbean was being drained and multiplied at the same time. At home, societies adjusted, churches became community anchors, extended families absorbed economic shock, informal economies filled the space where the state failed, identity hardened under pressure. Being Caribbean became less about territory and more about survival logic. Colonial education systems trained people to serve empires, not lead nations. English, French, and Dutch were enforced as languages of authority. Local languages survived in homes, markets, and streets. This split created a double consciousness, one voice for power, one voice for truth. That split followed Caribbean people abroad. In London, New York, Toronto, and later Miami, Caribbean migrants entered societies that needed them but did not fully want them. They were welcomed as workers and resisted as neighbors. Their accents were mocked, their politics were monitored. Their presence unsettled racial orders already under strain. Yet those cities changed. Caribbean migrants reshaped labor unions, housing movements, and local politics. They brought organizing traditions rooted in plantation resistance and anti-colonial struggle. They understood power as something external and personal at the same time. That perspective mattered. The Caribbean was no longer just exporting goods, it was exporting people shaped by empire. Back in the region, control tightened. The 20th century brought limited self-government, but economic dependence remained. Debt replaced chains. Trade agreements replaced overseers. Military bases replaced governors in some territories. The logic stayed familiar. The Caribbean sat at the intersection of shipping routes, global finance, and military strategy. Its location mattered. Its people mattered. its autonomy was negotiable. This is where relevance becomes uncomfortable. The region was small, but it could disrupt systems larger than itself. Labor strikes in sugar colonies rattled imperial markets. Political unrest threatened shipping lanes. Migration flows altered voting blocks in metropolitan countries. Caribbean instability never stayed local. That made the region dangerous in the eyes of power, so control became more subtle. Aid packages came with conditions. Development plans favored foreign investors. Education systems continued to prepare citizens for export rather than local leadership. The Caribbean was encouraged to see itself as dependent, peripheral, grateful. But daily life told a different story. Culture adapted faster than policy. Social norms shifted. Gender roles changed under economic strain. Religious practice blended old and new belief systems. Community remained the primary safety net. Caribbean societies learned how to survive instability without collapsing. That skill did not come from comfort. It came from repetition. Every generation inherited pressure. Every generation learned how to carry it. By the mid-20th century, Caribbean identity was no longer confined to the islands. It existed in port cities, factory towns, and urban neighborhoods across the Atlantic world. The region's influence was no longer tied only to geography. It was tied to movement. This is why the Caribbean still mattered, even when ignored. It mattered because it sat inside global systems rather than outside them, because it supplied labor, culture, and political ideas at critical moments, because its people understood power as something imposed and negotiable. The world often speaks about relevance as visibility. The Caribbean's relevance was structural. It was built into migration patterns, into labor markets, into racial politics, into cultural exchange, long before anyone asked the question out loud. By the time independence movements gained momentum, the Caribbean was already shaping the world beyond its shores. Not loudly, not evenly, but consistently. The region was no longer just being acted upon. It was acting back, even when constrained. And that raised a new problem for global power. If Caribbean people were shaping cities, politics, and culture abroad, what would happen if they gained full control at home? That question did not have an easy answer, and it would define everything that followed. Chapter 2, Culture as Infrastructure. By the time the Caribbean reached the middle of the 20th century, power had learned a lesson it did not like to admit. Control over land and labor was no longer enough. Caribbean people carried something harder to contain. They carried culture that functioned. This culture did not exist as decoration. It was not entertainment. It was not soft. It was infrastructure. It helped people survive displacement, exclusion, and pressure without losing coherence. And once it moved beyond the islands, it began reshaping the societies that absorbed it. Caribbean migration created communities under stress. These communities were rarely welcomed as equals. Housing was restricted. Employment was conditional. Policing was aggressive. Caribbean migrants entered cities already tense with racial and class conflict. Culture became the organizing tool. Language carried memory. Humor disarmed hostility. Faith structured time and responsibility. Food preserved dignity when institutions failed. Social rules governed respect, discipline, and belonging in environments designed to fracture them. This was not accidental. Caribbean societies had been trained for this. Plantation life forced people to build parallel systems beneath authority. Information moved quietly. Care networks formed without permission. Resistance learned how to hide in plain sight. Culture learned how to carry meaning without announcing itself. That skill traveled. In diaspora communities, Caribbean identity became a stabilizer. It told people who they were when the surrounding society refused to answer that question honestly. It created belonging without citizenship, authority without permission. This mattered politically. Caribbean migrants entered labor struggles with an understanding that exploitation was structural, not personal. They did not expect fairness from systems built on hierarchy. They organized accordingly. Unions, tenant associations, and community groups benefited from this clarity. At the same time, Caribbean people influenced broader Black consciousness movements. Their historical memory of empire, revolt, and negotiated survival added a global dimension to local struggles. Racism was not just social, it was economic, legal, and international. That framing changed conversations. But culture also faced extraction. As Caribbean influence spread, global systems learned how to consume it without honoring its origins. Language was borrowed, style was adopted, food was marketed, attitude was packaged, context was stripped away. The Caribbean was made visible and invisible at the same time. This created a dangerous imbalance. Culture traveled freely, people did not, influence expanded, authority did not. The region became known for what it produced, not what it demanded. Inside the Caribbean, this dynamic was felt sharply. Local societies watched their cultural output gain global value while economic conditions remained unstable. Young people saw identity celebrated abroad and constrained at home. This produced pride and frustration at once. Culture became both shield and trap. It protected communities from erasure, but it was also used to justify neglect. The Caribbean was framed as vibrant, resilient, and expressive. These qualities were praised while structural inequality was ignored. Survival was mistaken for success. This misunderstanding was convenient. Global narratives preferred the Caribbean as a source of energy, not authority, flavor, not governance, contribution, not leadership. Yet culture continued to do work the state could not. In the absence of reliable institutions, cultural norms enforced accountability. Elders mediated conflict, churches coordinated welfare, informal economies redistributed resources, respectability codes, however flawed, regulated behavior where law enforcement was mistrusted. This was not romantic, it was necessary. Caribbean culture carried rules shaped by scarcity and surveillance. Discipline mattered, reputation mattered, community memory mattered. These were survival technologies refined over centuries. As globalization accelerated, these technologies entered mainstream systems. Work ethic shaped service industries. Communication styles influenced advertising and media. Political language absorbed Caribbean directness and skepticism. The world adopted these elements without always understanding why they worked. This is where relevance deepened. The Caribbean was no longer just responding to global systems. It was helping them function. Cities relied on Caribbean labor not only for work, but for cohesion. Cultural norms smoothed tensions others could not address. Yet recognition remained uneven. When Caribbean influence produced profit, it was celebrated. When it produced critique, it was resisted. Caribbean voices were welcomed as performers and rejected as analysts. This contradiction revealed something important. Culture is tolerated when it entertains power. It becomes threatening when it explains power. Caribbean culture did both. It told stories of exploitation without academic language. It expressed resistance without manifestos. It preserved historical truth in forms that could not be easily censored. Songs, sayings, rituals, and humor carried records official archives avoided. Even when music itself is not the focus, its presence cannot be denied as a carrier of memory. But beyond music, everyday culture did the heavier lifting. The way people spoke about work, about authority, about time, about worth. These attitudes shaped how Caribbean communities navigated hostile systems. They also shaped how children understood the world. Diaspora generations inherited identity that explained marginalization without internalizing inferiority. They learned that survival was not submission, that adaptation was not surrender, that relevance did not require permission. This mindset unsettled societies built on hierarchy. At the same time, it created pressure within Caribbean communities. Expectations were high, failure was personal, respectability could become rigid, culture protected, but it also disciplined harshly. This complexity matters. Caribbean culture is not pure resistance or pure liberation, it is a response to constraint. It contains contradictions shaped by history. Strength and silence coexist. Pride and caution share space. These contradictions did not weaken its impact. They made it durable. By the end of the 20th century, the Caribbean was embedded in global culture far beyond its size. But embedding is not ownership. The region's cultural infrastructure supported global systems while remaining economically vulnerable. Influence did not translate into leverage. Recognition did not become protection. And that raised the central tension of this episode. If Caribbean culture helps the world function, why does the region itself remain treated as optional? Why is presence celebrated while sovereignty is negotiable? Why does relevance not equal power? These questions were no longer theoretical. They were shaping policy, migration debates, development models, and identity politics. The Caribbean had become too visible to ignore and too influential to control comfortably. And that made the next phase inevitable. Because when culture carries this much weight, pressure always follows. And pressure reveals who benefits, who decides, and who pays the cost. Chapter 3. Relevance under threat. By the start of the 21st century, the Caribbean's relevance was no longer subtle. It was visible in shipping routes, migration debates, security policy, and global finance. Yet visibility did not bring protection. It brought pressure. The region sat at the crossroads of movement. Goods passed through its waters. People passed through its borders. Capital passed through its banks. Decisions made far away continued to land here first. The Caribbean remained a hinge point in global systems that rarely treated it as an equal partner. This contradiction defined the modern moment. Caribbean nations gained formal independence, but autonomy stayed limited. Debt replaced direct rule. Development plans arrived pre-written. Aid came tied to obedience. Sovereignty existed on paper, while economic survival depended on external approval. This was not failure, it was design. The global economy rewarded openness without safeguarding stability. Small states were expected to compete with multinational power. Borders were porous for capital and rigid for people. Caribbean governments were pressured to attract investment at almost any cost. That cost was often local. Land was sold for development that excluded residents. Labor protections were weakened to remain competitive. Environmental damage was absorbed quietly. The promise was growth. The reality was vulnerability. This is where relevance became dangerous, because the Caribbean could not be ignored. Its location mattered. Its population flows mattered. Its instability threatened larger systems. Migration from the region shaped elections in metropolitan countries. Drug routes passed through its waters. Climate disasters exposed global inequality in real time. The Caribbean became a mirror the world did not want to face. Rising seas did not announce themselves politely. Hurricanes did not respect borders. Economic shocks hit faster in small economies. These realities turned the region into an early warning system for planetary crisis. But warnings were inconvenient. The world preferred the Caribbean as resilient rather than demanding, as adaptable rather than assertive. Resilience became a compliment that excused inaction. Survival was praised while conditions remained unchanged. Caribbean people recognized this pattern. They had seen it before. During slavery, endurance was demanded. During colonialism, patience was praised. During independence, restraint was encouraged. In the modern era, flexibility became the expectation. Always adjust, never disrupt. Yet disruption was unavoidable. As external pressure intensified, Caribbean voices grew sharper. Scholars challenged development myths, activists questioned debt structures, communities pushed back against land grabs and environmental damage. Identity became a site of resistance again. Not symbolic resistance, practical resistance. Who decides how land is used? Who benefits from tourism? Who controls food supply? Who sets migration rules? These questions moved from theory into daily life. Caribbean relevance shifted from cultural contribution to political friction. This shift was uncomfortable for global power. The region was no longer just influencing style or sound. It was challenging economic arrangements and historical narratives. It was asking for accountability rather than admiration. That demand exposed a deeper truth. The Caribbean has always mattered because it reveals how power actually works. It shows how systems extract value while denying agency, how culture is celebrated while people are constrained, how history is referenced selectively to justify inequality. This clarity unsettles those who benefit from ambiguity. At the same time, internal challenges remained real. Governance struggled under pressure. Corruption damaged trust. Brain drain weakened institutions. Violence affected communities already stretched thin. These realities were not imported. They were produced through interaction between local conditions and global forces. Responsibility could not be outsourced. Caribbean societies faced a difficult task: defend identity without freezing it, demand fairness without isolation, build resilience without accepting neglect. Relevance had to become leverage, not just recognition. This required strategy, not nostalgia. The past could not be replayed. The future could not be outsourced. Caribbean relevance had to be articulated on its own terms, grounded in history, but aimed forward. That meant redefining value, not as tourism appeal, not as cultural export alone, but as intellectual authority, environmental stewardship, and political voice. As a region that understands global systems because it has survived them. This perspective is rare. The Caribbean knows what happens when decisions are made elsewhere. It knows how policies land on real bodies. It knows how inequality feels before it is named. That knowledge has global importance. But importance without power remains fragile. The question, then, is not whether the Caribbean still matters. That has been proven repeatedly. The question is whether the world is willing to engage the region as an equal rather than a resource, and whether Caribbean societies can translate relevance into protection. This tension will define the years ahead. Climate pressure will intensify, migration debates will sharpen, economic instability will test small states first. The Caribbean will continue to sit at the center of these storms, not by accident, but by history. What happens next depends on recognition. Not the shallow recognition of culture alone, but recognition of agency, of authority, of voice earned through endurance and clarity. The Caribbean does not ask to be relevant. It already is. The unresolved question is whether that relevance will finally be respected or whether it will continue to be used without consent.